You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Anita Marks with you this evening in for Chris Carlin here on 98.7 ESPN. And if you hear dogs barking in the background, well, yeah, you will. And probably throughout the show. Why? Broadcasting live from the living room of my apartment. Back in the studio is Nikki. She's holding down the fort, producing the show. Nikki, hello. How are ya?
I'm doing well today. How are you?
Didn't play so well today on the golf course. This is so from what I understand, I'm going to be in for Chris pretty much maybe for the month whenever, I guess, either Chris is off or, you know, we do play musical chairs here. Maybe somebody else is going to take vacation. Chris is going to move into that time slot. And so this has become my, like, 7 to 10 has become my, like, my fill in jam, which is great because it plays. It's like it just sets up so perfect for my golf game. So I play golf in the morning, and then I'm home by the afternoon, have a nice little lunch, and start prepping for the show, and then do the show from 7 to 10. It's perfect. Life is great. It's how it works. But it's always better when I actually have a great round of golf as opposed to, like, a subpar round of golf. So I'm okay. I'm happy to be on the airwaves. Was not on last night, but back with you today. By the way, Nikki, who else is working on the show? I like to give you guys a shout out.
We've got Joel and Kyrie working from home tonight.
Joel and Kyrie working from home. Nikki in the studio. We're with you for the next 3 hours. Looking forward to the show. David Cantor, very dear friend of mine, one of the best NFL agents, is going to be joining us at 7:30, and so that's about 28 minutes. A lot going on in regard to the NFL. You know, the NFL, it's because the NFL is starting, well, hopefully they'll start in September. I've been saying I really realistically don't see them starting until October. Who knows? Maybe they don't start at all if things continue to go in the way that they're going right now in regard to COVID-19. But at the same time, there is conversation, there's discussion that is taking place between the NFL and the NFLPA in how the season's going to roll. And, like, for example, JJ Watt came out today and said that if we have to wear this protective face mask while I play, I'm not going to play this season. I'm going to sit out this season. Okay. That's JJ Watt, arguably one of the best defensive players in the NFL. On top of that, and I ran across this on Twitter last night, and that is the NFL is requesting that NFL players put 35% of their salary, that they allow the NFL to put 35% of their salary in escrow. You know, very similar to kind of like, you know, the road we walked down with the Major League Baseball situation and Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association trying to come to an agreement in regard to the percentage of salary that they would or would not make for the season. So it's just the tip of the iceberg right now when it comes to the NFL and the NFLPA. So David Cantor took that tweet, retweeted it, and said, oh, okay, so let me get this straight. You want us to play football, a sport unlike any others that are getting started. Let's be honest. You know, football, very a lot of physicality, most physicality, sweat, blood, tears, you name it, on one another. And at the same time, you want us to forfeit 30%, 35% of our salary and put it in escrow for right now, just to kind of see how, you know, this pandemic situation plays out for the owners financially. Yeah, no. So I saw that tweet from David Cantor. I said, oh, I got to get him on the show. So David Cantor is going to be joining us this hour. Some other little nuggets came out today in regard to, like, for example, the NFL. Now, Nikki, this is hilarious. I shouldn't say it's hilarious. Like nothing in a pandemic world is should be hilarious to us, right? Because, I mean, it's just god awful and so serious. But so the NFL is going to allow players to tackle one another. And like I said, like, you're spitting, you're breathing, you're bleeding all over one another. But yet at the end of the game, you're not allowed to exchange jerseys. Really? Really?
It's one of those things where you're like, I get where you're coming from, but I feel like you missed the
mark. Don't.
I don't really. Was that their attempt at saying, like, we're trying?
I don't quite get that. So, anyway. So we're going to dive into all that with David Cantor. That's coming up at 7:30. And then Charles Grantham is going to join us on the show in the second hour, former executive director of the NBA PA. So excited to talk to him as more players. The Lakers arrived at the bubble today. So more players are arriving at the bubble, getting ready for their practices to take place so that the season could kick off again. So Charles Grantham is going to be joining us. So really excited that we got him on the show. And Heather Dinich is going to be joining us in our third hour. Obviously, some of the biggest news out there is pertaining to what's going on with college sports. If you don't know, yesterday reported University of Stanford is going to cut 11 varsity sports, 11 of their 36. They've already lost $25 million. And so some of those sports, field hockey, volleyball, just to name a few, wrestling, just to name a few. Also Notre Dame, their AD came out and said that it's very, you know, less likely that there's going to be a college football season. The ACC has pushed back their start of players arriving till September 1st. The Ivy League said that they're out. The Power Five, their schedule is expected. So there's a lot happening right now when it comes to college sports. And so nobody's really on top of it better than Heather Dinich. So I'm excited to get her on the show. We'll have a click or don't click. And of course, you, 800-919-3776. But I do want to start the show off, and this is obviously has been one of the biggest, hottest topics, and that is DeSean Jackson and the comments he made a few days ago. And if you don't know, then I don't know. You're listening to Sports Talk Radio. You have to know the comments that DeSean Jackson made a few days ago. Anti-Semitic in regard to his Instagram post, pretty much quoting Hitler, In the realm of black people are the real children of Israel. Jews are here to extort America and to achieve world dominance. And obviously, since then, he backtracked. He apologized. The Eagles, obviously, he's an Eagle now. Eagles not very happy about that. And then Steven Jackson got involved. And Well, a few things. Before I get to Steven Jackson, DeSean Jackson came out and apologized and said that, you know, he wasn't aware that that was a Hitler quote and he misspoke and it's not what he meant. In a world that we are living in today, beyond just the pandemic, but where we are in regard to the Black Lives Matter movement, and trying to rectify and social injustice and all of that, I don't believe we have time or patience for ignorance when it comes to any form of racism. So, And I know that I'm sure the Eagles will sit back and give DeSean Jackson a pass, considering he came out, he put out a video, he apologized. I didn't know. I wasn't aware. Sorry. I'm sorry. I mean, the comments and the statements that he was relaying on all his social media platforms was pretty obvious. There was no like sub message in it. It was pretty damn obvious. So that is what it is. But then the situation got worse, did it not? With Steven Jackson coming in and really supporting what DeSean Jackson had to say. Steven Jackson saying that DeSean Jackson is speaking the truth, that he's educating others. And then and here's why the addition of Steven Jackson makes this situation worse. because all that Steven Jackson, as we know, was very dear friends of George Floyd. So in the storyline of what has happened in the past few months in regard to the Black Lives Matter movement, Steven Jackson is a chapter. He's a very big chapter, and he has a very big voice, and was and is very crucial in that movement, and the strength of that movement. And so now, by taking this stand and backing DeSean Jackson, it diminishes. At the end of the day, to me, it diminishes what Steven Jackson has done up until this point for the Black Lives Matters movement. At the end of the day, one race, one pain. You know, it's not like what African Americans or minorities have gone through hurts anything less than the pain that the Jewish community has gone through. Both have come from slavery beginnings. Both even today suffer through injustice, are targeted, hate crimes. So to make, I guess in looking at this, you know, I look at what the Black Lives Matter movement is very similar to what the Jewish community and what the Jews have gone through. To me, I look at it as an ally, not an enemy. And so that's why the statements that both DeSean Jackson and then Steven Jackson backing what DeSean had said just did not make sense to me. Let's listen in. We've got some sound here that Nikki has pulled from. Steven Jackson was on CNN last night with Don Lemon trying to apologize for him coming out and again, communicating, backing what DeSean said, saying that he was speaking the truth, educating others. He mentioned the Rothschilds, how they own the banks. Let's listen in. This is Steven Jackson with, again, Don Lemon on CNN saying that he doesn't hate anyone.
I could have changed my words, but there's nothing that said that I support any of that. There's nothing that I said that I hate anybody. I apologize for my words and I could have switched up, but that's the end of it. I know I love everybody and that's how I always stand. And I'm not going to let anybody demean my character because I'm not standing up here apologizing for a job. I don't work for nobody. I'm apologizing because what I stand for is love for all who have love for all. And I mean that. Mm-hmm. And that's just why I draw the line.
One of the things that Steven Jackson was trying to communicate is the inequality between how DeSean Jackson was being handled by the Philadelphia Eagles compared to Riley Cooper. If you recall, Riley Cooper, Caucasian wide receiver who played for the Eagles, was at a concert, and there was a black security guard that he called a racial slur, and it was caught on film. And so one of the things that Steven Jackson was trying to communicate in all of this that I think got lost in translation was how DeSean was being handled very differently than Riley Cooper. Let's listen in more from Steven Jackson clarifying his comments.
Nobody can find a video or article of me saying I hate anybody. I own something that says love for all who have love for all. I stand on that. In 42 years, you can't say I've approached any race or I stand different. No, I don't support any of that. Maybe I could have been more clear of what I thought DeSean was correct about, but I didn't feel the need to go into a conversation that me and him had about how they was treating him and Riley Cooper. I could have changed those words, but the people that know me, my Jewish friends that I talk to today, they know that the last thing I was spewing was to defend Hitler or any other post. That's why I didn't speak on Hitler or even speak on this post. I spoke on exactly what I agreed with, and they was handling him different than they was handling Cooper. That's the end of it. They can twist it how they want, but that's exactly what it is. I don't hate nobody.
My Jewish friends. My Jewish friends. Here's the thing. You know, we're trying to eliminate hatred, not facilitate it. And that's where this all went wrong in the last 24 to 48 hours, right? In this pandemic environment we're living in, there's not a lot of positivity. Black Lives Matter movement has been a huge, positive, powerful, something to get behind, something to, I want to use the word celebrate, because I do feel that it's one of the most powerful movements we've seen in quite a while. But the last 24 to 48 hours, this has derailed that. This has derailed it. And it didn't have to happen. And unfortunately, you know, it's obviously it's wrong in regard to what DeSean Jackson had to say. The Eagles will handle it. He came out and apologized. But I think the bigger hit here and the bigger negative here is that now, because of Steven Jackson's voice and presence and role in the Black Lives Matter movement, it diminishes it because of now of what he has said, not only in supporting DeSean Jackson, but him. If you watch the CNN interview with Don Lemon, it was uncomfortable. I was uneasy. It was evident that, you know, he doesn't have a team working around him to really kind of help shape and mold his narrative. It just has not been a good 24 to 48 hours for either Jackson. That's for sure.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Without further ado, David Cantor joins us, one of the best agents in the NFL. David, my producer, Nikki, tells me you were enjoying a nice bottle of wine while you're on with us this time.
A glass, not a bottle. Come on, Nikki.
Not about it. It's Thursday, David. It's Thursday.
It's every day during COVID-19 quarantine.
Ain't that the truth?
I'm in Florida, Anita.
I know you are.
We're where you guys were in New York 3 months ago. But
I was just going to say, you're the petri dish
it's
now.
Bad. It's bad. It's bad. We're led by morons. No leadership in America. It's absolutely horrifying.
Well, let's first and
Steve
foremost.
Steve Kerr for president.
How great would that be? All right. Hey, before we dive into it, because I really wanted you to come on the show because I wanted you to kind of talk about where your players are. I know you're really active with your players. You care a lot about the players that you represent. And I wanted to kind of bring you on so that you can kind of share with us like their mindset in regard to the NFLPA, the NFL COVID-19 conversations that are happening. But before we do, obviously, DeSean Jackson's comments not sitting well, compounded by Steven Jackson's comments. I'm curious, if DeSean Jackson was your client, how would you handle that?
I would, man. That's a great question, Anita. I'll be honest with you. I didn't think that far ahead. I didn't think that. Well, one, he's towards the end of his career, and two, I think if his $5 million or whatever the number is wasn't fully guaranteed, he would have been cut instantaneously. But, you know, talent over stupidity. I think my first instinct as a Jew was, yeah, uh-huh, that makes sense. Because as a people, we've been obviously tormented and hated on for hundreds of years. And certainly we have a lot of similarities to, in, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, a lot of similarities to what's going on with Black Lives Matter. I think the Jews have always been treated as a second class or third class citizen and spit on and discriminated against. And obviously, you know, in the ancient Egyptian days, were enslaved, much like the black people have been enslaved and bought into slavery and brought over here against their will. And unfortunately, I've always been a big believer in how much the similarities are between blacks and Jews. And I remember reading Cornell West and Rabbi Michael Lerner's book called Blacks and Jews a long, long time ago. The book probably came out in the early 90s, maybe even late 80s, and was just shocked at how almost identical our cultures were and how we were treated so poorly across the globe. And I think that what's happened is the rhetoric from a president who literally hates everybody that doesn't look like him, and that includes you, because one, you're a woman, and hates everyone who doesn't have his same ideology, and how he constantly and consistently and continually inspires hate in others is a big reason for why you're seeing such an uptick in these, I think they're called Karens, these white women who think that the rules don't apply to them. I saw today Rex Chapman tweeted about a woman at the dentist who said that she had spoken to her attorney in advance of coming in for her teeth cleaning, that she was not going to be required to wear a mask. And of course she was required to wear a mask. And I think that there's just such stupidity in our country. And I think that the best way to describe what DeSean Jackson did is ignorance. And stupidity is what Stephen Jackson followed it up with. And I think that they chose horribly inflammatory words and horribly inflammatory untruths that unfortunately people believe, right? When you tell someone that something is a lie repeatedly over and over and over and over again, they don't have any idea what the truth is. And that propaganda has been spewed by the GOP, by the Republican Party, by the president, and is being echoed by a lot of people across this country, whether it's the Jewish people, whether it's the whole George Soros stupid conspiracy that doesn't exist, that, you know, Hillary Clinton had an underage sex gang at a pizza parlor or somewhere in Connecticut. I remember that during the election. And then the false news and the fake news and the propaganda gets repeated and twisted, and it goes on Facebook. And there's just this crazy blurred line in our society where you can't have public discourse. You can't have people who want to have an education about something before they speak on it. And they speak in this platform, whether it's Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. And because they have followers, right, by the nature of it, followers are not necessarily people you always want to have in your corner, right? Because they're not leaders, they're followers. You get these men and women who are coming out and just saying such ridiculous things, but they're saying it with such compassion, and they're saying it with such conviction, and people believe them. And my fear is that it's only going to get worse the closer we get to the election. My fear is that it's only going to get more vengeful, more hateful, and more ridiculous. And I'll just give you my quote. And I say this whether you're part of the LGBTQ community or whether you're black, white, Jewish, Protestant. One of my closest friends is a Muslim. Our religions couldn't be more diametrically opposed. And I love him. And I wish him well on Ramadan, and I think he's one of my best friends. And my other best friend is a former client of mine, retired football player Eric Weddle, and he's a Mormon. And that religion and Judaism certainly don't mesh in any way, shape, or form. But my quote is, love is love is love is love is love. And if you love someone, it doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter what sport they play. It doesn't matter what their socioeconomic background is. It doesn't matter what their sexual orientation is. And I think that Americans especially, And by the way, this is a problem internationally. It's not just in America with the divisiveness and the racism and the anti-Semitics and Black Lives Matter everywhere. Every Black Lives Matter protest that I've seen has been a beautiful thing. It's been people of all races, religions, colors, and creeds coming together. And for DeSean to go and show bigotry, and Stephen, two guys I don't know at all, I felt sorry for them. Like, didn't you feel sorry for them yesterday?
I can't say that I felt sorry for them. I was more disappointed because I was probably more disappointed with Stephen because I know Stephen, and I felt that what he had, what he had done and what he had accomplished, and the power of his words and his statements after his good friend George Floyd died, was so significant and very powerful. And I felt like that this diminished that, and that was disappointing. I'd use the word disappointing, David.
Yeah, and I guess for me it was, I felt sorry for him because I was so disappointed in him, because I figured you've got so many answers to questions can be easily answered by typing them into Google. And it's just, what's it take, 10 seconds, 15 seconds to do some research to find out if this stuff is accurate, and to go out and spew that hate and create more hatred, right? And create a groundswell of, there's going to always be people that are going to believe him because he's got a platform, because he's great at his sport, because he's a celebrity, because he was so beautifully eloquent and so upset that his friend was murdered by the police. And so it's like, Steven, come on, bro. Like, come on, man. Like, we're all in this together. Nobody gets out alive. No one. None of us get out alive in this life. So love is love is love is love is love. And it doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter what you really, truly in your heart think. If it's not factually based and it's not about love, and there's that thin line between love and hate, and it really made me sad. I spent a lot of yesterday, hours, trying to figure out, because I have a little bit of a platform. I've got a few followers on Twitter, a couple thousand, and I thought maybe this should be something I should do. And I really like what Julian Edelman did. I really do. I respect the heck out of him for understanding how many people feel that way. But listen, there's a much bigger cause out there, Anita. And I definitely don't want some anti-Semitic stupidity and fake quotes by the worst human being other than Trump alive, Adolf Hitler. And yes, I believe that Trump is right there next to Hitler, if not even maybe ahead of him, because he hides it as well as Hitler. Hitler at least didn't hide it. And I think that we're at a really, really, really frightening time to be a parent in this country. We've got I know we're a sports show, but all these things impact sports tremendously, right? You've got MLS yesterday coming out in a beautiful, incredible ceremony where they were silent for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. Various players, black players, wore black gloves and did the Black Power salute, like John Carlos and Tommy Smith, 1968 Mexico City Olympics. You had players, referees, coaches, front office executives all taking a knee for the entire protest. And then the game this morning, I did not see the game, but I saw the photos. The players wore the names of the men and women who have been murdered by the police on the back of their jerseys, which I thought was just absolutely incredible. And I pray and I hope that that's the template for the change that Colin Kaepernick fought so hard for and gave his career for 4 years ago. I remember 4 years ago or 5 years ago when he first started taking the knee. I don't remember how many years ago it was. I said that 100% my children will know Colin Kaepernick's name like I know Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Newton, Martin Luther King Jr., Huey P. Newton, Rosa Parks names. Like, he will be talked about in the history books for life, for everyone, and the change must come. I went to an 83% black high school in Atlantic City, New Jersey, and I remember literally watching my friends get the shit, I'm sorry for my language, I'm sorry, get the you-know-what kicked out of them. And I was let go by the cops because I was white. It's like, well, I was in the same car they were in. You know, what did I do differently? My skin color. And I didn't know that. I couldn't process that at 17 or 16. And so I think that I'm hopeful that the Deshaun Jackson, Steven Jackson's anti-Semitic comments really make everybody understand how important it is that we all come together on this thing. And it's not just whether you're white or black or brown. And I'm optimistic. I got to be optimistic, because if you're not optimistic, you got no hope anymore.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Without further ado, Charles Grantham joins us. He's a professor at Seton Hall, but more importantly, the former director of the NBAPA. Charles, great to have you on our program tonight. Thank you so much for making the time for us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's start right there. First and foremost, I mean, obviously, you know, your tenure, your experience in regard to the NBA, your thoughts on the concept of the bubble in trying to prohibit COVID-19 getting into the bubble. Do you think this is going to work, Charles?
Well, I, like millions of fans, we certainly hope it's going to work, but it's one thing in theory to put together, and by the way, this is a Herculean task, a management task, to create this kind of a bubble with 22 teams. And personally, I would have probably limited to 16 just based on risk and probability. However, we're in it. We'd like to complete the season. It's now about recouping some revenue and minimizing costs. We recognize the enormous costs it takes to put this bubble in effect. But that being said, you're also changing, as the young woman was mentioning, the habits and procedures that so many of our young athletes are accustomed to. And in addition, you're adding an extra bit of mental stress and pressure that comes with just not only competing, but receiving a performance appraisal after each game that we're going to see in a very stressful environment. So the bubble and the creation of the bubble, trying to somewhat maximize revenue, minimize costs within a healthy environment, and trying to maintain that environment for the period of time. I've often said to my students and to friends that the team that really survives and wins this championship will have been the most disciplined team, with the ability of dealing with the multitude of distractions that come with this bubble. So on the one hand, they don't have to visit the, you know, X number of cities and teams, etc. But there's so much going on in the bubble just to maintain your safety and to ensure that your team is united and can still press for completing a season and then playing in the playoffs. So it's a tremendous task, challenging task. I'm hopeful, like everyone, that everybody completes these things in a safe manner.
Yeah, Giannis came out, I want to say it was last week, and said, you know, don't put a star next to whoever wins this championship, because whoever does, this will be, you know, the most deserving one because of all the obstacles that they're going to be facing the next 3 months.
So, well, it's quite a challenge, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So Charles, I want to say yesterday, Adam Silver came out and said his biggest concern is the virus entering into the bubble. And based on what we've seen in society, especially, you know, in Florida and Arizona and a number of states right now, this thing spreads like wildfire. In order for it not to get into the bubble, Charles, guys are going to have to obey the rules, right? And there's some talk and there's some speculation with players. You know, there's been NBA players who said, no way guys are going to, you know, not step out. Or, you know, that's really the big concern. You know, I look, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. I think it's going to be so important in regard to the players policing themselves and the players that have the biggest voice, the strongest presence, and the most respect, really overseeing that. Do you agree?
Yes. You know, now you're looking at team unity. You're thinking about how we take on this responsibility and how self-disciplined we are. We can't allow one person to go astray. And quite frankly, the pressure on prohibiting that is just as great. What player would like to be the one lone player that leaves and goes to dinner, comes back and brings the virus in? Okay. So there's no question that the team unity and leadership within that team, That's why I go back and say the most disciplined team, the team that's able to stick together, the ones that play together, the ones that who have in their mind their goal being a championship, and working together, collaborating, working together to achieve that goal, is going to be challenged like never before. So he was right. You can't put an asterisk there. If you do, you're going to talk about how outstanding the team effort was to make that happen. But yes, that is a concern. You're talking about young people between 22 and 35 who have families, but at the same time, they also have that extra burden of thinking about leaving that bubble and also the possibility of infecting their families at some point, because after the first round, the families are able to come in. So I think there's so many guardrails here. I'm hopeful that each one of these teams that have made it this far will have that kind of command from the coach on down to every day stress the importance of unity and sticking together and not violating the protocols.
Did you see the video today, Charles, of Embiid showing up in a hazmat suit?
No, I didn't see that.
Well, he's trying
to keep it light, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I guess. Charles Grantham joining us here on 98.7 ESPN, former director of the NBA PA. Another hot topic going in, obviously, the Black Lives Movement and Kyrie Irving had a very, very strong voice prior to the players making their way to Orlando, and concerns that if the NBA season does start, that it will take away from their efforts and their movement, helping that movement. I was watching today, and even the buses that are going to be transporting the players to the selective, whether it's the practice facilities or the three courts that the games will be aired at, were all labeled in Black Lives Matter. It's evident that Adam Silver and the NBA are aligned and want to do as much as possible to make sure that this platform, which I believe, Charles, is going to be heavily viewed and heavily watched, is going to really allow the players to continue to contribute to that movement. Are you, based on what you've heard, what you've read, and who you've spoken to, do you feel the NBA is doing enough in that regard?
Well, I marched in Washington with the Martin Luther King in 1963, okay? So in terms of protest and march and making people aware and keeping the conscious level of what's important here, Martin Luther King often said that, through education we kind of affect attitudes, but it's legislation and court orders that effectuate change and behavior. So while I think it's great and I think it's wonderful that we keep these themes in mind, I would also have thought about bringing in someone like Eric Holder, who was the former attorney general, Sherilyn Ifill, who's the president and CEO of the NAACP Legal Fund. Why? Because they were instrumental in creating what we call consent decrees with police departments, right? With police departments, starting back in Ferguson. Now, you want to effectuate change? Well, there are several bills that are out with regard to the national and local bills changing the behavior of police in our various communities. That's a legislative process. So I would be thinking that I would be encouraging bringing some of these people to address and to educate our young people, at the same time initiate a relationship that will foster that kind of ultimate change. And that's what it's going to take. Protests are great, and I think the one difference that clearly I've seen, and this is why I think change is on the horizon, in 63, in 60, 70, probably 85% of the marchers were Black. Today, it's almost 50-50 in some cases. So the white America has supported the Black Lives Matter push. But in order, again, to effectuate change, it takes that kind of effort, knowing who can effectuate change where it's most important. And right now, that's Congress.
Charles, last one for you. Just talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, Stephen Jackson, such a vital part of that, obviously, because George Floyd was his very dear friend. And unfortunately, the last 24 to 48 hours in regard to what DeSean Jackson had said and in quotes that he posted on social media that were from Hitler, and then Stephen Jackson kind of supporting what DeSean Jackson had put out on social media, and then since then the last 24 hours apologizing for it, and your thoughts on all that has gone down. Do you feel that this has diminished in any way, shape, or form what Stephen Jackson has meant to that movement?
No, that he's come out and apologized, but again, it only accentuates this issue, this question of if in fact you're going to be out and speaking on these topics, you have to be well aware of the social media and the other kinds of distractions that may come about, and zeroing in and maintaining that focus on, let's say, Black Lives Matter and the kinds of programming and or on a local and national level that can support that. So that's mistaken comments which have been retracted, but I'm hopeful that he will maintain his allegiance to the movement and still be outspoken.
Charles, thank you again for spending time with us this evening. Really do appreciate it. Great to hear your voice. Really happy that you're safe and healthy, and God bless.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
A good friend of mine. We've known each other for quite some time now, and really does a phenomenal job covering college football for ESPN, and that is Heather Denich. Heather, welcome in. How you doing, my friend?
I'm okay. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you. Thank you for joining us. I know it's late, and I do appreciate your time. First and foremost, this is a conversation I've had with a number of friends who've asked me, if there is no college football this season, will programs go under and never resurface? Is that a legit concern for a number of universities, that if they go a season without college football, they will never recover from it? Is that a realistic thing?
I think it's only realistic at certain smaller levels. I don't think you're going to see that amongst any of the big boys. The FCS schools and the Ivy Leagues are in completely different situations. You know, I talked to the executive director of the Ivy League, Robin Harris, and she talked to me about how it wasn't a financial decision. And it's different because you're talking about schools like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton that have endowments, and they don't have to fund their athletic program through one TV contract that has to support 27 other sports, right? So I think it depends on, you know, where exactly you're talking at, what the athletic budget was before. And I know there was a lot of questions and kind of eye-popping about Stanford cutting 11 sports. And there should be, because, whoa, it's Stanford. And how are they in financial trouble? Because they have great endowments as well. But when you look at the average, they had far more sports than most schools did and probably needed to cut a few. They, before the coronavirus pandemic even began, they were a little bit behind in their budgetary planning. So I think it really is a school-to-school thing, but I don't think that you will see that be a huge trend. A big problem, if there's no football, absolutely devastating. But I can't tell you how many wouldn't survive it.
Well, you know, we just coming in, you know, we heard all the news that has surfaced the last 24 hours, and Notre Dame's AD coming out and saying, you know, now more than ever, he's feeling less likely that there's going to be a season. You know, Ohio State, Ivy League schools. Based on the conversations that you're having, Heather, and, you know, maybe this isn't the wisest question, but listen, us women, we're always good with our guts. What is your gut telling you in regard to the season? Do you believe that there will be a college football season this year?
I think that the schools that can play will play. I think that it will be eventually a survival of the fittest type season. Based on what we're seeing now, as far as the coronavirus cases and the skyrocketing numbers in certain states, I mean, you can't throw a dart in Florida, Texas, or Southern California and not hit a campus of a Power 5 school, which is a huge problem and a reason for all the pessimism, obviously. But these Power 5 schools are determined that if there is a way to do it, they're going to do it. Now, if the health officials and the government say you can't do it, that's when they raise their hands and say, all right, we surrender to this.
But isn't that's a big part of it. Like, for example, right now, you know, we here in New Jersey, New York, we got hit first. We got hit hard. We reacted quickly. So right now, you know, we're kind of better than the rest of the country. So let's just say, hypothetically speaking, tomorrow NFL camps open. Well, the Jets and the Giants and the Bills and like those teams are have an advantage over the Bucks and the Jags and the Dolphins because Florida's a hot mess. Mm-hmm. So, in my mom has always said to me, sweetheart, life isn't fair, but like, there should be a fair playing field, and a fair playing field, whether it's college or football, is you go to the facility, you're able to utilize the facility. Like right now, Dolphins couldn't open up their facility. There's no way. There was 55,000 new cases in Florida alone on Saturday. Compared
right.
to here. So how does that work?
I think conferences have to figure out how many teams do you need to be able to play to have a season, to your point, right? And Mike Oresko, the commissioner of the American Athletic Conference, told me that they've basically already determined unofficially that if one or two teams can't play, they're going to plow through and they're going to try to play without those one or two teams. And I would suspect it to be the same throughout the other conferences. Now, if you get to a point where I don't even know what the percentage is, five teams, half, I don't know, can't play, then is that when you say this isn't going to work? I mean, there are so many questions, but to your point, it from the very beginning and right till now, it remains a state-by-state, county-by-county, school-by-school, campus-by-campus thing. And university presidents are not getting enough credit for the role that they play in this, because if campuses are not open, all bets are off. There's not going to be fall sports. Well, go ahead.
Because you know, friends, I'm really dating myself here, but like my friends who have kids in college are like what they're being told is that their children are going to go to school for this semester and then not come back after Thanksgiving because universities are worried. So right now they're going to go to Colgate, for example, like they're going to go to college, right? They're going to be there, what, September, October, and then November when they come home for that break, that winter break, whatever, Christmas, Thanksgiving break, they're not going to come back because A, they're too worried that they'll come back and with the virus, and B, scientists are expecting that quote unquote second wave come November and December. So how is that going to play into this?
I've been told that if there are universities that go to that model, that it wouldn't necessarily impact the football team because they have played before while students have gone home for breaks or practice or whatever it might be. but now, if all the other question, too, is if all the students are taking online classes and are not allowed on campus, how do you justify allowing student athletes on campus? Now, at USC, they said we're going to go online classes for the fall, but we're going to allow students on campus for things like labs and whatever else they might have to do on campus academic related. So there's a loophole there for athletics to be on campus as well. But again, are you splitting hairs? Or you've got to determine the protocol for all those things, but it all goes back to what university presidents determine for the regular student body.
Heather Dennett joining us here on 98.7 ESPN. Here's another thing, Heather. Like, you know, we're talking about 18, 19, 20-year-old guys. And, you know, and girls who obviously who play other sports, whether it's, you know, college basketball, whatever the case may be. But like, take me back to college. Like, I don't like I'm just being honest. Like, I don't know if I would be I don't know if I would quarantine myself in my dorm. Like,
right.
Like, you know, so much like, you know, and let's relate what's going on in the NBA with the bubble. Right. Adam Silver came out and said, my biggest concern is guys not abiding by the rules that we've set in place. And they step out. They do something foolish. They bring the virus into the bubble. And once that virus gets in the bubble, forget about it. It's going to spread like wildfire in there. And then all hell's going to break loose. So Adam Silver is worried about grown men who play basketball for a living doing the right things. Like, can you really expect 18, 19-year-old men at college to do all that they need to do to stay safe and to make sure that everybody stays healthy? I hate that I'm going to say this, Heather, but there's just a part of me, because you know we've been friends for a long time. You know how much I love sports, and you know how much I love my football.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a part of me, Heather, I just feel like we really shouldn't be doing any type of athletic activity until there's a vaccine. And I hate that those words came out of my mouth. I just hate it. But it just seems like it, regardless whether it's college, pro, basketball, football, hockey, it's such a tall task to make sure or to try to maintain a healthy environment for these guys.
Not to mention expensive task. The NBA's bubble, what is that costing? $150 million. And you can't certainly operate college athletics or college campus in a bubble. As you speak, I'm thinking that at every level in every sport, discipline might be the greatest competitive advantage out there right now. And I'll tell you what, one program that is working is Notre Dame. They have their players in a hotel, and Jack Swarbrick, their athletic director, today I asked him, I was like, you guys tested like 240 people, one positive. Why is this hotel thing working for you? And he said, because the kids listen to us. No more than two people in an elevator at a time, no congregating in rooms, and you try to stay around the hotel and the athletic facility as much as possible. He's like, we've got some older kids who go to their, you know, residences and do their laundry or whatever. But for the most part, these kids are listening to us. And then you've got their first opponent, Navy, who has the advantage of literally saying in the military, you can't leave the yard, meaning the campus, right? So they're there. They're being tested twice because they're in the military. They're quarantined. And they can't go to downtown Annapolis and go to the bars and stuff. They got to stay within the perimeter wall, literally. So there it works, and they're playing each other. So maybe that game will happen.
Hopefully. Your thoughts on what has taken place? I haven't heard a lot about Clemson this week, but there was another sports talk radio host here in this town that just kind of threw out the notion. And I'm not criticizing him, because it's a conversation that I had with a few of my friends. And at one point in time, I kind of thought out, hey, are the Clemson football players purposely contracting COVID-19 now? So, you know, the thought process is once you've had it, you won't get it again, which, by the way, that has not been proven yet.
Right.
And that way, when the football season rolls around, like, we'll all be great, because the number of cases with the University of Clemson is off the charts. So what happened there? What's that about?
Well, I certainly can't speculate as to that, but I mean, they're in a hot spot, and so is North Carolina. North Carolina just shut down. But again, you're not hearing them say, we're not going to do this. They're just announcing their numbers, right? And Ohio State hasn't even announced their numbers, but they announced that they paused. So I'm curious as to how many positives the Buckeyes have. I think it all goes back to, everyone knew when they came back on campus to start voluntary workouts, they were going to have positive tests. But it goes back to your point that you were just talking about earlier. Once they come back on campus, then that's it. All bets are off. They know that they can control them within the however limited time they have them in the athletic facilities. But once they go out, I mean, they're hanging out with each other. They haven't seen each other in forever. Who knows where they're going? I think that's more likely the cause for higher numbers.
Last one for you, Heather, and that is, you know, I have friends who are teachers, and, you know, we're still discussing whether or not schools are going to be open this year, right? Like, mm-hmm. and they're concerned. I mean, you know, kids are kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Nick Saban. I think of Harbs. There are a number of some of the best college football coaches that are age-wise compromised. We don't know the details of their health, mm-hmm. but a number of them, they're kind of in that age range that you've got to have a concern. Like, have you had a conversation with any of the coaches in regard to, you know, how concerned they are that they're going to be coaching, again, young men that might not necessarily abide by all the rules, like we're seeing Notre Dame?
Well, I actually had a funny, an interesting conversation with TCU's athletic director, Jeremiah Donati, and I said, have you and Gary Patterson yet figured out what you're going to do if he tests positive? And he said, well, you know, of course I'll have to quarantine for 14 days, but think about this, he said to me. He said, what if he's asymptomatic? Or what if he was just in the same room as somebody else who tested positive, and he has to quarantine because of that? He said, you're talking about a healthy head football coach who is being asked to quarantine for 2 games. It's like it'd be like trying to cage a bear. I mean, you can't coach even though you feel fine. And from the athletic director's perspective, he's saying, I'm paying you $5 million. Of course I want you to coach, but you can't. So who takes over? I mean, there's all kinds of questions that go along with that. But, yeah, and it's not just coaches and staff members who are over the age of 60 or whatever it might be. There are plenty of college football players with underlying conditions. Plenty. I think of James Conner at Pitt, who had no idea he had cancer until he was playing football there. Mark Herzlich at Boston College, 2 players I covered when they went through their cancer process. What if that would have been them? And many players. And what's not getting enough credit is the many, many parents who are voicing concerns about sending their kids back.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.